Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Snapshot by George Wallace and Don Keith. Narrated by Corey M. Snow. Prologue. The Sea of Okhotsk, bounded by the Kuril Islands and Hokkaido, the northernmost Japanese home island, but mostly by jutting peninsulas and Asian shorelines long claimed by Russia, is a strange and curious place. More than anything, it is unforgiving. Its murky, ice-mottled waters can morph from a glass-smooth calm into a raging maelstrom before a sailor can even contemplate seeking shelter in a safe harbor. The land surrounding the sea is equally mysterious, empty, and forbidding. Except for some dilapidated seaports that ship out the production from a few hardscrabble mines and oil fields, the lonely coniferous snow forests of the taiga are populated mostly by Siberian tigers and wolves. Half a planet and 7 time zones away from Moscow, the bosom of Mother Russia, well east of even the vast nothingness of Siberia, this pool of rimy seawater and desolate shore is mostly a forgotten land. On the mainland, almost equidistant from the deep ice of the Arctic Ocean and the East Siberian Sea to the north, and the Sea of Okhotsk to the south, the long-forgotten encampment of Veseny 69 sullies the snowy landscape. There, where the subarctic taiga melds into the Arctic tundra, the rude assembly of log and mud huts sits, seemingly abandoned. They appear to have finally surrendered to decades of deep, crushing, packed snow and neglect. Veseny 69 has historical significance, though. It was the last of the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics' infamous gulags. But Veseny 69 was different. It was a camp that did not officially exist. Nothing about it appeared in the Ministry of Internal Affairs' official records. It simply was not there. This secret camp had been reserved for the Soviet Union's most hardened and dangerous political dissidents and enemies. Ones who still had some value, grueling, soul-breaking labor, to offer to the advancement of the proletariat and the state, yet who were best kept hidden away to protect the people from their dangerous ideas concerning such arcane, decadent fantasies as democracy and capitalism and the rights of free men and women. Isolated in the roadless, trackless wilderness, the only way to reach the gulag, or to leave it, was a wintertime trek of over 200 miles down a nameless, frozen-over stream all the way to the first road out at the little outpost of Chersky on the Kolyma River in Siberia. At one time, 200 or so inmates at the gulag labored at mining the meager veins of gold that spiderwebbed out beneath the permafrost. It was a slow go, but the trickle of bright, sparkling minerals helped fund the oppressive costs of the government, or the lavish vacation homes of the political leaders and favorite oligarchs of the USSR. The isolation and brutal conditions left the prisoners with no illusions. The only way they could ever leave this awful place would be in a crude pine box buried below the permafrost. The only civilizing consolation was that the Veseny 69 camp had a few women dissidents among its men prisoners. Even under such impossible conditions, a few romances developed and thrived. Then, deep in the winter, in December 1991, during a night when the camp thermometer registered negative 45 degrees Celsius, the first child of the gulag was born. Apparently unrelated, a few days afterward, there was another momentous event. Without explanation, the guards and their commanders all walked away, disappearing downstream, swallowed up by heavy snow and fog. This left the dazed, but now free, prisoners, including the newly arrived infant boy with the especially strong cry, totally to their own devices. In the beginning, their only goal was survival. But over the ensuing years, That would change. Mightily change. Ivan Dostoevsky throttled back on the snowmobile as it crested a low rise. Gazing out into the snow-blown distance, he smiled. Nothing seemed to have changed here at all. The thick trees of the taiga formed the same seemingly impenetrable wasteland that he remembered so well. No signs of another human being for as far as he could see in any direction. Employing a pair of powerful binoculars retrieved from his pack, he peered off to the northwest, the direction he had been headed before he paused. There, he could just see the merest hint of smoke rising from the remnants of Veseni 69. Good. It was a reassuring sight. Some of the others were already gathering there, getting ready. Still, as the oldest among them and the designated leader of the Children of the Gulag, Dostoevsky would have preferred being the first to arrive for the reunion. The first to begin building the fire, literally and figuratively. But the unexpected blizzard, even the state meteorologists of Mother Russia had become hopelessly corrupt and lazy, had delayed his leaving Chuvanskaya. Then the deep wet snow had bogged down the snowmobiles so much that the short 200-kilometer run had required that he camp in the wilderness for 2 nights, trying to find sleep despite the distant a cappella serenades from the wolves. Dostoevsky restowed the binoculars. Then he checked his Saiga sporting SA 7.62mm rifle safely stowed and ready in its scabbard at his side. Likewise, his SR-1M Vector 9mm automatic pistol, tightly strapped in its shoulder holster. The last few kilometers were the most hazardous. The Children of the Gulag were well and truly family, but survival depended on being overly careful, whether with the wild animals of the forest or the much more dangerous ones who walked upright and sported opposable thumbs. For certain, after the discussions and decisions of this day, life was going to get very dangerous indeed. But if by some miracle of hope and determination they were able to accomplish their goals, he and the other children would soon redraw the political maps of planet Earth. 1. The bitter wind swept down across the bare tundra and forested taiga with a vengeance. Nothing diminished its strength or blocked its way as it left the shoreline behind and roared out across the frozen sea of Okhotsk, only miles and miles of driven snow and thick ice. The landscape was just as it had been for eons. But this was already, after only its first month, one of the coldest winters in this barren land's history. Every living creature had disappeared earlier than usual, seeking the deepest, warmest shelter that it could find to hibernate. Nothing moved except the driven snow and wind-tossed limbs of the conifers. Beneath a meter of solid ice, Jim Ward squinted as he peered at his control panel and carefully piloted his miniature submarine toward a rendezvous scheduled to take place hundreds of miles inside hostile Russian waters. Silent electric motors pushed the small black hull through the pitch-black sea, but the only way for him to tell they were moving was the readouts on the panels in front of him. The wan winter sun was up there, he knew, and there was a modicum of daylight yet. But that old orb was nowhere near bright or direct enough this time of the year to send its rays penetrating through the thick ice on the sea surface overhead. And even if a few stubborn rays did find their way through, there was nothing to see down there anyway. Maybe the odd pelagic fish out in search of lunch. Ward's submarine, oddly dubbed by the U.S. Navy a Dry Combat Submersible, or DCS, was so quiet that the fish were in danger of inadvertently bumping into its hard steel skin. It was large enough to transport a pilot and a navigator, along with up to 8 combat-ready SEALs. However, DCS Hull 4 was mostly empty on this trip. The only ones aboard were SEAL Commander Ward and his co-pilot navigator, SEAL Lieutenant Junior Grade Willie Duncan. The forward passenger compartment and the lock-in lockout compartment were both empty. Ward and Duncan were in the cramped command section located in the DCS's aftmost chamber. That was where they controlled the 14-ton sub. "About time for the next waypoint," Ward called across to his co-pilot. For the past 3 days, the pair had ridden the DCS over 200 miles, mostly while it was under control of its autopilot system. They had lifted off the back of the submarine USS George Mason while in the Sea of Okhotsk's deep central basin, well to the south of their current position. Finally, they were nearing their destination at the far northern end of that mysterious body of ice water, and well within territorial waters, where their incursion could be considered an act of war by the Russians should they be detected. Ward well knew that, considering the state of relations between Russia and the United States these days, fire and brimstone would certainly be a possibility should they be noticed. Regardless, it was now time to make final maneuvers to get them to the point for the secret rendezvous that brought them and their vessel way up here. A meetup that would absolutely expose them and their submersible to possible detection. Ward could only hope whatever it was that required a person-to-person meetup in this inhospitable place would be worth the effort and the risks. Willie Duncan hunched over the navigation display panel.
"Just a second, boss," the young SEAL responded. "Taking a fix on the Turcom sonar now."
He swiped his fingers across a couple of pop-up commands on the touchscreen. Then he sat back, stretching as he watched the big flat panel relating the results as the sonar computer did its job. The screen display slowly built an image as the covert navigation sonar painted a picture of the bottom of the sea stretching out ahead of the DCS. At the same time, the computer matched what sonar was showing to the bottom contour map stored in the device's memory chips. A light blip on the screen that signified the DCS's position suddenly shifted slightly, a couple of yards to the right to correct their actual position, and then it automatically updated the inertial navigation system.
"Dead on course," Duncan reported. "Time to come right to course 055. Yam Island rendezvous point is 10 miles ahead on that bearing."
Ward punched the new route they would follow into the autopilot, and could feel the change as the DCS smoothly swung around and steadied up, now aiming to the northeast.
"Probably as good a time as any for us to come up and see if our passengers are ready for pickup," Ward said. "Willie, what does the ice on the ceiling look like?"
Duncan shifted the Turcom sonar beams so that they were now looking upward.
"Solid ice returns for as far as it can see," he announced. "Maybe we can find open water closer inshore. The meteorological weenies seem to think that there are some hot springs near Yam Island, and they should prevent ice formation."
"Yeah," Ward grunted. "That's why we picked it for the rendezvous. Hope those eggheads are right. This little tub won't be very good at punching through thick ice, and I'd rather not announce our arrival by blasting a hole through it. But if we have to, they made sure we knew to do whatever it took to make this little conclave happen."
It took the pair another couple of hours, but they finally located one of the promised hot springs.
And as predicted, there was a small patch of open water only a few hundred yards off the high, rocky beach that edged Matikal Island, the largest bit of land in the Yam Island group. Ward carefully raised the sensor mast until its video camera just peaked above the water's surface. The large screen flat panel in front of Ward showed a dark, gray, cloud-covered sky merging into a gunmetal sea. The steep rock cliffs of Matikal Island filled one whole quadrant of the view. The rest was flat, open, empty sea ice. And nothing else.
"Okay," Ward said, considering the bleak landscape. "Willie, see if our friends are ready for their Uber pickup."
Duncan hit a button on the radio, setting loose a burst of super high-frequency digital data. It was the agreed-upon signal to set up the rendezvous. Then they waited and waited. After 2 hours with no reply, Ward lowered the mast and let the DCS settle down easily to the sea bottom.
"All right, then, let's get some dinner and then hit the rack," Ward said. "The plan is for us to wait 24 hours here. Then we try again. If no luck on the second attempt, we turn our happy asses around and head home and chalk this one up as a fun sightseeing cruise into the lovely Sea of O.
Without even checking out the local nightlife?
Not unless you consider listening to me snore to be nightlife, Willie."
Ivan Dostoevsky was beside himself with frustration.
Finally, after all the preparation and anticipation, it was time for the children of the Gulag to emerge from the shadows, spread their wings, and claim their rightful place in the realm of mankind. Years of carefully planned and precise maneuvers, all to set their little group of freedom-seeking dissidents into a position in which they would declare themselves to be a free and independent nation, to get ready to finally throw off the heavy yoke of Mother Russia. All this only to be stymied by a faulty snowmobile carburetor.
"Boris, how much longer?" he irritably questioned his companion.
Boris Basarevich was one of the senior children of the Gulag and Dostoevsky's lieutenant.
"About the same as I reported to you 5 minutes ago, Ivan, but maybe 5 minutes closer to resolution."
He bled some more gas out of the carburetor on the obstinate snowmobile's engine.
"Until I get the water out of the fuel lines, it will continue to freeze up and block the feed, and we are going to sit here and get on each other's nerves. If you want to walk, the rendezvous point is only 15 miles due east."
Boris pointed off in the direction that was directly opposite from the setting sun. Dostoevsky shook his head and watched as Boris leaned over again to continue to fiddle with the carburetor. Both men knew it was fortunate that they had not yet reached the open ice when the snowmobile decided to stop running. With some punishing pushing and shoving, they had managed to get the beast into the sheltering lee of a rock face. Their tent gave Boris a reasonably warm place to work, at least warm enough that he was able to remove his gloves. Dostoevsky looked at his watch. They had missed the first rendezvous window by a half hour. The next one was only 24 hours away. If he should miss that, the whole delicate process of convincing the Americans and then setting up a meeting would have to start again from the beginning. How could he explain to the admiral who oversaw U.S. naval intelligence that his grand and historically ambitious plan had been sidetracked by bits of ice forming in the gas line of a snowmobile engine? Even if the admiral still took him seriously and was still willing to allow the get-together to reschedule, many precious weeks would be lost. With delay came a loss of resolve. Loss of resolve could result in diminishment of the will to believe. And the will to believe was essential if they were to successfully accomplish what they intended. Ivan Dostoevsky grabbed his cross-country skis and his backpack from where they were strapped to the back of the snowmobile. Boris did not bother to look up. He buckled on the skis, checked his GPS receiver, and turned to Pasarevich.
"If you somehow get this beast fixed in the next 6 hours, head out onto the ice and find me. If you cannot find me, go back to Magadan and tell the others that I am meeting with the Americans. Unless you hear otherwise, everything will still progress according to the schedule on which we have agreed. The biggest thing right now is to get the mining team up to Veseni. We will need all the gold we can get pretty quickly if these negotiations pan out. Understood?"
Boris started to say something, to assure Dostoevsky he would fix the machine shortly and catch up to him out there on the frozen sea. But Ivan was already out the tent flap and gone. He skied haltingly down the rocky beach and then found a zigzag path around mounded up ice on the sea surface, headed more or less east. 2. It was midnight when the blizzard struck. However, in the land of near sunless winter, midnight was just a position for the hands on a clock and nothing more. A winter cyclone blew relatively warmer, moisture-laden air from the Sea of Japan up to and over the mostly ice-covered sea of Okhotsk. There it collided with a fast-moving Siberian cold front tumbling southward out of the Arctic like an express train. When the wet, warmer air met the frigid wind of the front, it instantly dropped its temperature, causing the warmer air to lose its moisture in the form of vast quantities of thick snow. There was total whiteout within minutes. Ivan Dostoevsky was almost halfway across the frozen surface of the sea on his hike to Matikil Island. He was making very good time when the blizzard hit. Instantly, his vision dropped from being able to see the far-off horizon all the way down to not being able to see his own gloved hands if he stretched out his arms. Born and raised in the Arctic, he instantly knew that his survival hinged on finding shelter. He would have to get out of the wind and snow, and quickly. But he was in the open, out on the sea ice that stretched off in all directions. Where could he possibly find any place to get out of the wind and blinding snow? His only chance would be to build some kind of snow cave, maybe within the protection of one of the ice pressure ridges that heaved up 4 or 5 meters high all around him. As he slogged the last 7 miles or so since leaving Boris Pasarevich, the bulky snowmobile, and the shore, he had cursed the ridges popping up to obstruct his path. He had to ski far out of his way to get around them, as if picking his way through a maze, yet still try to maintain his course due east. But now, one of those damnable hillocks might just save his life. Skirting a particularly tall and steep pressure ridge, Dostoevsky found just what he needed. A snowdrift already piling up before the driving wind. Working quickly, he dug a trench in the snow, carefully tamping the walls to make them as solid as possible. There was only enough accumulated snow to build the walls about a meter high. Working quickly, he laid his skis and ski poles across the top like rafters, and then spread out his little tent over the supports to form a roof. Not much insulation, but at least it would protect him from the wind as the snow rapidly built up while the storm blasted through. It would have to suffice. There was nothing more he could do to make the shelter any better. He would die if he did not get out of the wind before frostbite or hypothermia set in. He crawled through the tiny entrance, shoved his pack in behind him to cover the opening and keep the wind and snow out, and huddled in his crude snow cave. Now to sit and wait out the storm, and hope it did not last days, as they sometimes did this time of year. But while he waited, he could build resolve for trying to complete the remaining distance to within range to confirm the meeting point, even if he had to leave the shelter and brave the blizzard to do so. The men waiting for him would not tarry, and he could not blame them. They would be in real danger. Sitting there in the cold darkness, he also had time to think. Dostoevsky's mind drifted back to Vesenye and to the very earliest days of the Children of the Gulag. Life had gotten even more difficult for a while when the Russians suddenly left. His parents had told him of the hardships they all faced. Some of the same, as always. Weather, scarce food, vast distances to travel if they decided to leave. Some different challenges, and even more difficult to overcome without the opportunity to prepare for them. Providing their own necessities, medical care, and more. They relied on their wits and survived as best they could. Or at least a majority of them did. Some did not. Anger and resolve mostly got them through. That and the determination to raise the children and to instill in them the idea and plans for the eventual breakaway to true freedom. From his earliest days, Dostoevsky had accepted the idea that the guards had been Russians and the Russians were the enemy, the oppressors. His own people were always the people of the Gulag, the parents of the children, separate and apart from the Russians. It had been the Russians who had imprisoned the people, merely because of their opinions and their courage to express them, or for their refusal to worship the state as a god. The Russians and the people were no longer fellow countrymen, brothers, kinsmen. Then, on that fateful day, the Russians simply fled, abandoning parents and children, casting them aside like so much worthless trash. Their former guards naturally assumed the prisoners would not survive. But when they did, the ideas began to flourish, even as they eked out a bare existence on the edge of the forest. As their numbers had slowly grown through procreation, the parents honed and shared with the children the potential to create their own sovereign nation, one where thoughts and freedom could thrive, and gulags would be no more. Not to ever be forgotten, of course, but their one-time existence and what they stood for providing a constant source of their strength. Over the years, they made contact with others who had also managed to survive in similar gulags after they, too, had been abruptly abandoned. The children of the gulag were not surprised to learn there were others like them spread across what the outside world called the Russian Far East, or that some of them had independently contemplated a similar future.
not to try to escape to another nation, to building their own, right there, in the only home the children had ever known. The children began calling the region Nash Dam, or Our Home. Slowly, the dream of Nash Dam truly becoming our home, free from the Russians or anyone else, grew and spread. The Russians had abandoned them in this land. It was surely their destiny to claim it as their own, putting their own mark on it from its inception. It had all been nothing more than a dream, until the eventful day, almost 2 decades before, when they discovered that the unimpressive gold vein that the Russians had exploited at Veseny 69, one their captors was convinced had been mostly mined out, actually contained far more gold than anyone could ever have imagined. And once discovered, it was relatively easy to dig it out. Under the guidance of Dostoevsky and others among the children, the gold was secretly mined and then cautiously smuggled out to hungry markets around Asia. Smuggled out in ways so as not to spook the market or give anyone any idea of where it was coming from. As gold prices soared, the cash from the sale of the mineral was carefully hidden in banks and investment institutions around the globe, relying on trusted friends and relatives who had long since abandoned Mother Russia. Most of the money was saved, but some was used to purchase modern technology, defensive weapons, the required machinery to continue to pull the gold from the frozen ground, and the day-to-day needs of the children and the older people who were left. Children from other gulags had also discovered in their area deposits of lithium, iridium, and ruthenium, and other obscure but precious commodities, each of which suddenly had value on the world market and could fund their cause. Dostoevsky and the children finally had the assets to make their dream of Nash Dam come true. But now they needed help. Help from someone who had an axe to grind with Russia. The timing finally seemed right. Russia was clearly preoccupied with spreading influence and annexing territory to the west and south, primarily east of the Urals, from Ukraine and Turkey to Syria and Iran. No one seemed to care what was happening in the Far East, other than Vladivostok, where the Russian Navy's Pacific Fleet was headquartered. But who? The Americans? The Chinese? The Japanese? Korean? North or South? Dostoevsky did not really care. He would try them all. The USA was the first on his list, but only because he now had a contact high within that country's navy. A contact whose name was provided by someone inside China who had somehow, impossibly, heard about the cause of the children and reached out. And for some reason supported them and their dream and trusted Dostoevsky to keep that support and help completely confidential. Dostoevsky shook himself from his reverie. The wind had abruptly fallen silent. The blizzard had blown by even more quickly than he had hoped. That happened sometimes, too. Or it could be only a short lull. Either way, he knew it was his only chance. He pulled his backpack away from the entrance and started to crawl out. But the snow had piled even deeper than he had expected, covering the opening. Heavy, wet snow. He was effectively buried. He glanced at his watch. There was only an hour to the last rendezvous time, and he still needed to cover 10 kilometers. It would take some tough skiing if he had any chance of making it. With a frustrated groan, Dostoevsky began to dig furiously, desperately, using both hands. Jim Ward slowly lifted the DCS from its resting spot on the muddy bottom. It was time to come up and make one last attempt to contact his passenger. If no one replied, then they would head back to the George Mason empty-handed. He was already dreading the conversation he would have to have with his father, Admiral John Ward, Director of Naval Intelligence, telling him that the carefully planned and very risky mission he had assigned them had been a bust, a waste of time and taxpayers' dollars, and the bit of fiction the Admiral had concocted to steal his son away from his usual SEAL duties. "Excellent training opportunity, though," his dad might tell him, but only if he were in an especially good mood. It was odd that Ward was thinking of his dad just when Willie Duncan spoke up, saying,
At least you got your chance to be a submarine skipper, like your dad.
What?
Oh, you mean driving this mop?
Sample complete. Ready to continue?